You asked for it and you got it. It's our auction strategy, Appalooza 2024 edition, a full episode dedicated to fantasy baseball auctions. How to bid, how to prepare, how to hypnotize your opponents, how and when you should nominate Jacob deGrom. Kick off your Crocs and relax and enjoy our yearly staple episode of Beat the Shift. And welcome to another episode of Beat the Shift Podcast. I'm your host, Ariel Cohen, and I have a special guest here, Ariel Cohen.
How are you doing, Zach?
How's it going?
Not a bad impression. Not a bad one.
It's not the best, but a lot of people do you on their shows. I don't know if you care, but I guess I'll find out.
The only one I've heard is Ian Khan do me, but it's nice to hear people try to imitate me, and I guess I'm not that hard to imitate. It's a little bit higher voice, and I talk in a little bit of a sing song type of you have it over there.
Yeah, all good. So Ariel, thanks for coming on. We were recently in an auction together, and you were we were talking a little bit after, and you're a great auction player, so I wanted to have you on. So you, as everyone knows, you do the ATC projections, and you're a fantastic fantasy baseball player and great guy, good sport, obviously. You're an actuary, right?
Yeah, my day job is not fantasy baseball. I work for an insurance company. I do all the number crunching. If you don't know what an actuary is a guy who calculates the future, what can be in the future and all the mathematics about it. And you'll typically see actuaries working for insurance companies. And so that's what I do in the day job. And of course, that does apply to fantasy baseball. So I brought it over, and that's the brand of fantasy baseball that I play is very mathematical. And it comes from that kind of background that I have.
Well, you know what? A lot of these fantasy baseball podcasts that you listen to have a lot of BS at the start of it, so this should be no different. We shouldn't get to the actual fantasy baseball content right away. So what I have prepared is actuary riddles for you.
So
here's a riddle. Let's see if you can, because I did take actuarial science, so I do remember some of the stuff from university. So what do you call it when you're looking at the probability of Jorge Soler hitting a home run at Oracle Park, when you know it's 70% sensitive and 60% specific?
I have no idea.
The answer is Bayes' area theorem. So, Bayes' theorem.
Okay. Yeah, sure.
Okay. So that's sort of how it goes. I got one more. That was sort of a tough one, but okay. What do you call it if you're using actuarial science to remove one of the top five starting pitchers from a matrix? What would that be called? Ooh. So, like your top, like just to give you a hint, your top five starters might be Burns, Strider, Cole, Wheeler, Gausman.
I have no idea where you're going for this.
Gausmanian elimination. Okay. Do you get those jokes?
Yeah, I get them all. They're all.
I'm pretty sure no one else listening would get them. But I figured I'd prepare something special for you.
Yeah,
feel more comfortable as an actuary. Okay, so. As you know, the fantasy baseball community, we need to clean it up. There's a lot of dumb shit being said. There's burner accounts that are out of control. There's feuding everywhere, and rulings need to be made on important leagues. An example was just recently I talked about the main event seating request in Las Vegas. I got a lot of feedback both ways, and I do want to say a couple things about this. One, I had every right to bring that up because I felt there's an inequality. I don't work for the NFBC. I don't work for an affiliated site. I'm not a reporter. I'm the customer. Don't forget who answers to whom. If everything is above board and nothing needs to be changed, no one should be upset that I brought it up. Like if it's all good anyways, then it should be pretty much common knowledge for everyone. And if the rule being changed is being changed, that was originally resisted being changed, then it's not for no good reason. And I don't want to keep repeating myself about this because I did talk about it before, but I do understand you can cherry pick and avoid people on online main events and stuff like that. But the live events where tables need to be randomized, that could represent 20% of the entire contest with hundreds of thousands on the line. It may seem minor to avoid a few people for whatever reason. Fine. That's fine if you wanted to do that way. But like everyone should get that opportunity, including myself. And if others get to handpick, then so should I. I don't want to use that word handpick, but I guess avoid certain players. I'll step back on the handpicking comment, but yeah, like I would avoid Phil. Like Glenn Schroeder was at my table last year, and so was Jen's dad. Yeah, sure. Like I wouldn't want to face him either. Posma, Mike Mager, and his fab pen pal Winoker. Winoker was in every one of my main event or every one of my live events last year, and I asked to avoid him. So, but the list goes on. Anyways, it's a little bit hypocritical in my opinion that I'm getting blowback for how I communicated this on a podcast rather than, let's say, a phone call when there was a communication gap with the NFBC customers because many were not aware of this. And I'm hearing about the solution through word of mouth. So, Ariel, how can we avoid issues like this in the future? We need order. We need structure. The NFBC is just one wing of the fantasy baseball community. There's so much more. And the NFBC cannot operate autonomously like this. What I believe the fantasy baseball community needs is a president. We need a president of the fantasy baseball community. So we need at least two candidates and at least two parties running, like the US presidential election. And I'll suggest some nominations or some nominees. Ironically, their fantasy baseball ideologies are opposite to their corresponding political beliefs. So first, you got the Republican candidate, who has to be Mike Masato. Either love him or hate him, but the orange-tinged entrepreneur speaks his mind and is very articulate and charming when he needs to be. He puts his business first and doesn't back down or sell out. He believes in a meritocracy and that resources are wasted when it comes to bringing diversity into the community. He wants to build a wall to keep the TGFBI entrance out of the community. He also would be the only president to lose money during his time in office. Now you're thinking, who is a liberal candidate? That has to be none other than Lenny Melnick. His cognitive skills are comparable to a toddler, but he is someone who has been around for decades and no clue how to operate technology. Vice President Lamont would be the first female VP, and having a female VP would go a long way for the voters. Presidential candidate Melnick would stress diversity in the community and cut resources from high-stakes leagues in favor of mock draft software. He would implement a voting system that enabled voting based on podcast affiliation rather than being citizens of the community. He would tear down the wall, the TGFBI wall, and allow people to defect from all over the globe and start their own pitcherless podcasts so they can gain more votes. The following podcasts are actually currently in the works. NL El Hombre, which is on the wire in Spanish. Premier Lanzamiento, which is First Pitch. Sala de Estudio del Dugout, which is Dugout Study Hall. En la Esquina, which is on the corner. Durmiente y el Busto, which is Sleeper in the Bust. Nick Pollock y Amigos, which is, you can figure that one out. And En la Granja, which is on the farm. Finally, and this is the last, I won't go on for much longer, there has to be an independent candidate, so a third one. And I think that independent candidate should be Chris Liss, whose candidacy stems on theories such as Raz Slam is a money laundering scheme, and Lenny Melnick actually owns Razball, and the TGFBI border crisis is unsustainable, and the competition will deteriorate even more than it already has. It's an existential threat to the community. The way it happens is there's a coordinator on each side of the border, and they set up podcast platforms for the undocumented individuals who are recruited via Snapchat. He anticipates over 150 pitcherless podcasts to be formed and over 1,500 TGFBI entrants by 2025. So that's my suggestion for the fantasy baseball communities. We need a president.
great job at that, Zach.
Who would you vote for?
Well, obviously we want a coalition government with everybody here, but let's go for Mike. Let's go for Mike. He just tells it as it is, right?
Yeah, exactly. All right. So we have actually another segment called the Fantasy Baseball Trivia of the Week before we start. Okay. Did you hear that?
Yeah, that's
okay. So this is our trivia question. So Patrick Sandoval had 23 unearned runs last year. And these stats are via Twitter. Who was the only pitcher to have more unearned runs than Patrick Sandoval last year with 24?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm going to say Blake Snell.
No, it's actually Ariel Cohen. I looked at all your stat lines and I actually counted. You beat Patrick Sandoval by one, but it's different because it's softball.
Yeah. Well, you know, in a recreational softball game, a lot of the runs come on errors and stuff
Yeah,
like that.
there's a lot of errors. It's mod. If you play the modified, right?
Modified baseball, yes.
Yeah, I've played that before in Toronto. They had a league. I don't play it anymore, but it's different. What is it like 40? You pitch from like 40 feet away?
Yeah, so there's different leagues do different things. One league I do is 43, the other one is like 46. Yeah, I mean you're pitching underhand there. It's not like high arc where you know you're waiting for the ball, waiting, and then you're hitting it, and everybody's crushing balls. There are strikeouts. I mean, I've pitched faster these days, so I'm generating more. I'd say that if I have a bad day, I'm striking out three. On a good day, we're talking six or seven. So
That's
there are
pretty good.
strikeouts. Yeah, that's pretty good. When I started pitching, which was a couple of years ago, you know, if I got one strikeout, I'm like, wow, that's amazing. But you know, you learn to throw certain pitches that move better than others. You learn the sequencing. Sequencing is very important. It
Yeah.
works in baseball and in softball as well. But yeah, 24 unearned runs is probably higher than that if I had to guess.
Well, you probably didn't post every game, so yeah, it's probably higher than that.
Yeah.
You know, when I played, like there wasn't many strikeouts. Like our pitcher, like he was okay. But it wasn't, he'd be lucky to get like one or two a game.
Yeah, so this is not like beer league softball. This is not where you're just a bunch of guys who cares comes. Like these are good players, you know. We're not talking about athletes that will make any, you know, a minor league stint or have played college baseball, but we're talking about really, you know, the better athletes of the crop. We're not just lounging around and having beers.
Right on. Okay, let's get into the episode. We want to talk about auctions. So everything about auctions. We'll talk about auctions in general first, and then we'll get into the auction that we were in together. And I was listening to your podcast with Jeff this morning. I haven't had time to get through it all because we had to start this podcast. But I did get through the beginning, and you sort of had rules to auctions. I was listening to yours, and it was interesting. And I agree with them what you said. And I thought, okay, what sort of rules, or tenets of auctions would I come up with? And I wanted to get your thoughts on. And here's one. The opportunity cost of missing, at the end of the draft is the largest. So I think the drop off from those one or $2 players to like players you don't want at all is the largest. And your ability to pivot is the smallest because if you miss on your mid-round targets, you can still pivot to later players. So I think your ability to go $2 or $3 over top of people with the hammer is the most important place to sort of have that hammer, to use that hammer.
It really depends on the format and the league depth. If you're talking about a 10-team league, I don't know if that's true. I think in a 10-team league, the first couple of waiver wire or the reserve round picks are probably fine. If you miss on your dollar, $2 players, you probably can get good stuff. If you're talking about a deeper league like a 12-team mono league, I think that if you miss out on your $5 players, the pivot from 5 to 1 is horrendous. So it really depends on there. What you're talking about is probably 15-team league, and the drop off is probably about there, $1 to $2 to reserve. But yeah, it really depends on the format. You know, auction in general is a principle, but the actual cliffs, as you might want to call them, really depends on the depth, I think.
Yeah, no, you're right. I was more referencing the 15 team leagues that like the one that we played in, the 15 team mixed league on the NFBC with seven bench spots and two catchers, five outfielders, right? But your
Yeah.
point definitely stands. So the next thing that I would say is know your high variance players and determine when to bid on them so that you know the players that are going to have a high variance in terms of how much they're going to cost. Me, I just know from doing a lot of auctions, the guys that are sort of like your industry darlings or breakout players might have a bigger variance. Like you might see a guy that is sort of has an AAV of $10, but you know this guy could go like 15 or 18 if it's at a point in the auction where people have excess funds.
I think that when you're talking about high variance players, we're talking about players who in some drafts go high and some drafts are not as much. Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah, it all depends on when they're nominated.
Yeah.
So if those high variance guys, like if they go out, I find if they go out early, then like they might go for a little bit of a premium. But if they go in the middle where like you're at a point where like two players have like $100 left and everyone else is down to like say 40 or 50 on average, then those two or three players with $100 are just gonna have excess funds at that point. Though you can see them going for a huge premium, but near the end of the auction, if they don't get nominated and you can able to shield them from being nominated, then you can get a good deal on them.
I mean, I think it really depends auction to auction, year to year. If you have a hot auction, then we're talking about having very good bargains in the middle where everybody's fighting over those top players. And in the middle, I don't see the large premiums. But if you're talking about a cold auction, then you're going to have that where players are not going that much at top and maybe you should get one or two. But in the middle, people are just have too much money to spend and they're overbidding. And I find that it really matters auction to auction, year to year. It's not a general principle. When you go into an auction, I'm prepared for either case. Right. If things can come up, depends on the dynamic. Maybe you have four guys in the room who are, oh, my God, they just want to spend $45, $50 on every single player. And then you can come into a certain auction, maybe a 9 a.m. auction where everyone's pretty mellow and you don't have that. So it really depends who the people in the room are above anything else.
Right. That makes sense. So that leads into my next point, which I said that keep a running tally of surplus and deficit in the auction. So like you referenced hot or cold at the start of the auction, and also players that you believe should be reserve round picks that are going in the auction. So when I'm looking at, like, I listened to what you said this about in your most recent podcast with Jeff, and he sort of said that if people are really hammering the star players early and paying big premiums for them, then you know that you're okay to pay a little bit of a premium on it because you don't want to be shut out, and you know that there's going to be deals later on. But also at the same time, I like to keep a tab on, say, like pitchers that I don't believe should be auctioned. They should be more reserve round picks. So if I see, like, for example, in our draft, Paul Skeens, and like I've seen Cade Horton, these prospects or other pitchers such as, like, I don't know, Tiedemann, I'm just listing prospects, but there's probably others that maybe like Keaton Wynn or Jordan Wicks that don't really belong in the auction in terms of like what you see regularly. If they start going there, then you know that you're going to have more opportunity and better value for your, I guess, cheaper pitchers. So you can sort of allocate more funds to your hitting.
Yeah, I mean, if you get a sense that people are taking some random darts that maybe the ADP indicates are going much later and they're pushing them up and spending $1, $2, if you think that there are some good $1, $2 pitchers, you'll have a better chance to get them. I mean, it's really all about going where they ain't. It's zig when everyone's zagging. If everybody is pushing up those darts, well, you're going to have some maybe tried and true or some of your players that you want in 1-2 in 1-2 space. If everybody is spending at the top a lot of money, I got to get the Julio and I got to get the Witt. Well, there's going to be some dull players in the middle rounds that you're going to be able to get quite a bit of. Everything has to displace each other. It's a zero sum. You have to remember it's a zero sum game, the auction. If one quantity, let's say steals, if steals are going, oh my God, CJ Abrams is going so high and Story's going high and all these guys with steals. Well, you know that there's going to be more bargains for the power guys, right? Everything is zero sum. So the question is how you tackle it. And I'm usually the zig when everyone else is zagging, because any time where there's a demand, you're going to find demand elsewhere. You can win an auction by going elsewhere. You don't have to get what everybody else wants, right? There's many ways to win an auction. You don't need a prospect to win an auction. You don't need a high-valued outfielder to win an auction, right? You don't actually need it. Now, you do need certain categories, but you can either fill in later or you can punt is a strategy. I mean, I'm okay with getting only 3 points in steals if I'm getting 15 elsewhere, right? It's a conglomeration and mix, and there's no one formula that's going to work. So you just want to go cheap as you can. I mean, here's the general principle. In a snake draft, you have to get a $40 player, and you have to get a $35 player, and you have to get a $30 player because you have a first-round pick and a second-round pick, third-round pick. But you don't have to do that in an auction. If you think the $40 players are terrible values, go for two $25 players if you think you're going to get more out of that.
Right on. All right. Projections. Let's talk about projections. You, of course, are the ATC guy, but I had an agenda drafted, but then all the questions are questions that wouldn't really lead to good discussion or stuff that's been asked before. But I wanted to talk about something specific. Just doesn't really. It can relate to ATC. It could relate to Steamer, the bat. It relates to anything. So we're not necessarily talking about ATC here. But Theory auctions are a derivative of the categorical projections and the corresponding anticipated impact on the SGP. So note the words theory, projected, and anticipated. Nothing is like actual in theory. But in practice, the AAV, average auction value, don't reflect this because people are either dumb or they're maybe smarter than the projections. So people choose their own destiny. Now, my point that I'm trying to get to is it's possible to leave an auction with basically no steals. Like, it's possible, or like next to none, say 10 or 20. It happens. It could happen. It's almost impossible to leave the draft with no runs or RBIs. You'd have to be really, really bad to leave like with under 700 RBIs. So take a guy like Jose Abreu. His auction value that you would calculate or whoever would calculate that's smart enough to run these projections and auction values, it's based on all his accounting stats. So it's going to be, so like his runs. So he might be projected for only 60 runs, but those 60 runs equate to 4 or 5 SGP, depending on how that calculation works. So he's still getting rewarded for that. Combine that with all the other stats from his like home runs and stuff like that. You get a number, and then you compare it to the replacement value. You take that number and you subtract the replacement value, and then you get a value for Jose Abreu. But my question, and I'm not sure about this, are those runs really, should he be rewarded for like runs that are like basically at replacement value? He can easily and completely get those runs on the waiver wire, 60 runs. So I'm saying that like when you look at the SGP of a player and you compare it to replacement value, you're not separating each category. So like the opposite is true for stolen bases. Take Ellie De La Cruz. The replacement value for those stolen bases on waivers is basically nil, because like they're just not available as readily as runs. But also getting those stolen bases from someone on the waiver wires is probably going to crush you in another category. So basically, long story short, I'm asking you, does auction values that are derived from projections really not account for separate categories enough? So are stolen bases being undervalued? My gut says yes.
All right, so there's a bunch of things to unpack there. First of all, when you project, let's say, Ronald Acuna for 125 RBIs, you're not actually, and you're evaluating how much 125 RBIs are worth. It's not the 125 that's important. It's the excess of what the replacement level player is. As you said before, everybody is going to have some 30, 35, right? There's some level of RBIs that everybody's going to get. Nobody is in baseball and is going to have 0 RBIs, right? Or runs scored. Right. I mean, just not. So you're not paying for 125 RBIs. You're paying for 90, 95, whatever the excess is over the replacement level, what you could theoretically get on the wire, right? Of course, that's true by position, right? You're paying at the outfield position for it. At catcher, of course, the replacement level is lower. You're not getting 30, 35 guaranteed RBIs. You're maybe getting 25. So the excess for a catcher is going to be over the 25, right? That's why there's a catcher bump, right? You're paying more than what a true, just the actual stat line is worth.
Yep.
So again, remember, you're paying for excess stats. Now, the other thing, though, is there is no replacement level player that has exactly the theoretical levels. Like if you would calculate what that would be, maybe it's 9.5 homers, 1.2 stolen bases, and 35.7 RBIs, right? There's some theoretical fraction number that's for everyone, but the waiver wire doesn't look like that. You don't have a guy, everyone is not guaranteed to have 4 stolen bases. It's usually 0 stolen bases and you have a power and RBI element. Or you have 10 stolen bases and there's like 3 homers, right? There's a mix of types of things you can get. The thing is that you have to see how valuable a player is or how unique a player is when you're buying in the auction, you do have to look at the waiver wire and say, what can I get on the waiver wire? Can I get a stolen base guy? Can I get RBIs? Can I get runs? Uniqueness makes somebody worth more from supply and demand, right? You're paying more for an Ellie De La Cruz above what you would normally do because it's harder to get those stolen bases. I know you mentioned that, you know, if you buy a stolen base guy, you're getting garbage stats. Well, yeah, there's a level below which, why in the world would I get this value? It's just draining me everywhere. I'd rather roster a pure homer player, even if I get zero players because he's just hurting me everywhere else. But we're talking about the top of the waiver wire pool, you know, the top 25 players that are acceptable to you. They're within $2 of auction value and they can fit in and get some stats in for you. But, you know, you have to see what that makeup is worth. And that influences the premium that people are willing to spend in the auction for a certain statistic based on what you can get to replace them. But of course, you have the other opposing factor in the fact that when you draft an Ellie De La Cruz, you're counting on a lot of stolen bases just from him. There is risk in drafting him. I call it profile risk, right? If Ellie De La Cruz gets injured or if Ellie De La Cruz underperforms, right, which is possible, either one can happen, you have an outsized drain on your stolen bases now that can't be solved in the waiver wire. So to draft an Ellie De La Cruz, you are taking on the risk. So you have the positive thing for him in that there's uniqueness of profile, but you have the negative thing, which is risk of the underperformance or injury of the profile risk. For me, they sort of even out. I in terms of calculating, I don't bump up players because they're unique, or I don't bump up players mathematically that much because of the profile risk. Although, if you do calculate it, and I've studied this, the profile risk does outweigh uniqueness. Like I've seen players like, Esteri Ruiz, players who have an outsized component, they generally tend to make less than my expected values predict. Like if ATC says it's a $10 player, over the years, that's corresponded more to like a $9 player. There's a small shift downward. So if anything, I would actually argue that you should count more of the risk component than the uniqueness. And so for me, I think that people are mispricing those quantities, and it is a buying opportunity or an avoiding opportunity to avoid the heavy Ellie De La Cruzes that are going for a big market premium where your numbers show there's a big risk.
Right. So in the higher stakes leagues, like if I refer to the NFBC, why do you think the pitching is pushed up so much? Because I'll just cite that there's two ratio categories, ERA and WHIP, and speed is pushed up a lot. I'd say the ratios, average ERA WHIP and speed, are scarce. And those are categories very difficult, especially ratios, to find on waivers in a 15 team league. So do you think there is some sort of non-quantifiable, or I guess we just choose not to quantify the value of these specific categories that we're just not capturing in some of these models?
I'm sure there's a way to quantify it, or at least to address it. Uniqueness of profile and sort of the anti-correlation between the waiver wire. Like if you took the waiver wire and you looked at the, call it like a Z-score spread of the waiver wire, you would see that there it's probably devoid of stolen bases, right? The average stolen base total is lower than the average player in the actual draft. And so there is a supply-demand issue, and I guess you could quantify that some. For most people, they basically say, oh my goodness, there's a scarcity, we need it. Or, oh my goodness, we need a starting pitcher, the innings are drying up, we need to do it. And they're pushing it up, you know, they're pushing up over the stats. The stats, remember, projections and stats and valuation follow a specific formula, for good or for bad. There are game theory components of the game that aren't addressed in there. I mean, if you're doing an FGP formula, an FGP is basically saying, how much do you need to gain from one gain a standing point? I have 7 points in steals, how much to gain to 8? Well, I mean, if you're at the top, if you have, you know, the maximum and you have 20 stolen bases over somebody else, well, you didn't need 10 of those stolen bases. So how much were stolen bases worth to you really is different from everybody else, right? To have a one size fits all is missing the game theory component of it, right? And people are more supply and demand driven than what the average numbers dictate, because there is the game theory component. And that's why you see it. I also think in the case of starting pitchers, I do think that you have the issue of the fact that the past couple of years, let's go back like 7 years, 6 years, 5 years ago, the starting pitchers were extremely good buy. Like, I remember the days when no pitcher would go for more than $20. You'd be crazy. Oh, pitchers are so volatile. Forget it. But then you had that period of time with Kershaw and Sale and guys like that, where if you bought a pitcher for $27, that was a good return. You got your value. There was less risk. I even wrote an article about it. It was called The Case for an Ace, saying that there's less risk. Of course, you should spend more on pitching. And people sort of follow that en masse. And it's ingrained in them that you do got to spend a starting pitcher. They also see that, well, now because there's fewer innings, to get those top pitchers and the 200-plus inning guys, that's worth something. That's a unique profile. So they continue to push that up. I think the baseball environment has a lot to do with it. It could be quantified a little bit, but I think the game theory component of everything is not properly quantified by just the standard SGP is the issue.
Right, and one more thing I'm gonna ask you about this before we move on to the actual meat of the agenda is that I was looking, just to hammer home this point, do you think we ignore the projections by position sometimes when we're looking at valuing players specifically? And I asked this question on a previous podcast to Phil when Phil was on my podcast, was specifically third base. Those players that steal bases at third base, are we not giving them enough relative bump? And I will share my screen with you just so you can see what I'm talking about. I took your ATC projections and I took the 210 players that you would auction in a 15-team league. And I just sort of I sorted it by ADP, and then I made sure I had 30 catchers and enough players at each position. And really what you're looking at is the bottom here is the average stats from each of these position. And what you have here is you have catchers that have an average of 17 home runs, 52 RBIs, 57 runs, 3 stolen bases. And then I've heard people say, I'm just going to divide catchers and treat everything else the same. However, if you look at the corner infield, it's drastically different than the rest of the field, which consists of middle, outfield, and utility. Corner infield, you have an average of 23 home runs, whereas the rest of the field, except for catcher, has 20. And then stolen bases are drastically different. Corner is an average of 7, whereas the middle and outfield and utility is 14. So it's almost double. So my question is, a player like a Ke'Bryan Hayes, who might steal you 20 bases at third base, or an Ellie, like in our, I guess, standard calculation that you may do or someone smart like you would do, are we not giving that enough of a weight?
I don't think so. I mean, you can get your stolen bases from any position. You don't have to get it from the outfield or middle infield just because there's more. Obviously, it helps for Ke'Bryan Hayes to be able to steal bases at the corner infield position. But remember, if you're getting your stolen bases there, you're trading off and maybe you're getting less power there. But in the middle infield, you find there's more stolen bases and less power. So the question really is, are you paying a premium, right? If Ke'Bryan Hayes is, if you get him, you know, you're going to have to get your power elsewhere. Can you get the power at the middle infield to compensate at a bargain, or are you paying a premium? Like maybe middle infield is where the steals are lighter. If it's easier to get a middle infielder that steals, you don't have to get that in the third base position, and you could use it for elsewhere. I don't think that there should be a premium associated with it. In fact, I wouldn't do that, because you can choose where to get your positions out of it. It helps you as much as any other stat, right? With a catcher, catchers are worse batting average wise. If you get a good batting average catcher, sure, it helps you. But remember, everybody else is getting that value drain. It means that if you don't have to get the average elsewhere, but wait a minute, you've already gotten it, right? It's sort of a cycle, right? It puts less stress on the other categories, but of course the other categories are easier to obtain. So I wouldn't value them any different. Does Phil have a different answer? Does Phil think that they should?
No, I suspected there'd be something to it. And you both, you had the same answer as he did. You both said, okay. No, like you both basically said the same thing. So you confirmed what he said, which is, I guess, easy to understand. There's less follow-up for it because it's just something that I was curious about, but, Oh, that's interesting. Interesting to hear your perspective. You went into a little bit of other, you went into a little bit of a different level of detail than he did, which was good. I think your answer was really good there. Bjorn, what's up?
Hey, Zach, how's it going?
Hey, thanks for popping on.
Hey, Ariel, how are you doing?
Hi there. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. I thought of you this last weekend. I was at a car auto dealership because there was a recall because we needed some underbody corrosion protection on the car. And you'll never believe what they had on TV. It was PBTV. Are you familiar with that?
Pickleball television, of course.
Oh, you know it. Oh, I thought you might be. So you've caught some of the pickleball television before?
Ben Johns and Anna Lee Waters, of course.
I you know what? Oh gosh. Can you see what I wrote down here? I wrote down one name. It's Anna Lee Waters. They were at the Desert Ridge Open this past weekend, and that was some amazing pickleball television.
She is so freaking good to watch, and she puts her heart out on every single play. She's a joy.
She is like, I don't even know. Is she the Ronald Acuna of pickleball?
Oh, her and Ben Johns are the top. They win almost everything they enter. I mean, they were playing somebody the other day, and like record against these people are 23-0 or something. You know, it's crazy. Yeah. By the way, when you said you were thinking about me, I thought you were reading some, you know, male model catalogs, but you know.
Yeah. I mean that too. Yeah, I know. The ball went through his legs, and she hit it back over the net. It's like watching living art, watching those two go at it. So, yeah, pickleball TV. That's Desert Ridge Open was a great watch. So yeah, no, I'm excited to be here and talk with you.
And hopefully, I'll participate in one of those events in the future.
I mean that would be awesome, male model, and so you're pretty good with the stick in your hands. I love it.
All right. Well, auctions in general, let's talk about them. I alluded to it a little bit before, but I like to look at the disparity between the auction AAV and the ADP in like the snake drafts. Right now we have Draft Champions League snake drafts, and you have I think there's probably been 10 or 20 auctions that have taken place, one of which we were in. One thing I've noticed that's consistent year to year is starting pitcher becomes more valuable in auctions. Breakout players become more valuable in auctions, but at what expense? Closers and catchers become cheaper.
When you mean valuable, you mean more expensive?
What did I say? I said starting pitchers
become valuable. More valuable.
Poor choice of words. More expensive. They're going to cost more. The starters are going to cost more. Catchers are going to cost less. Relievers are going to cost less relative to their snake counterparts. So why? And this is my theory. I think the closers and the catchers, they have a homogeneous skill set. So I think the differentiation between one another is not huge. Whereas in a snake draft, you have runs. So like in rounds 10 and 11, that run of catchers, there becomes a pressure that gets put on them, and their price is elevated. They become more costly because those runs happen. In an auction, you can control, it's more controlled. So I think those players are they all become cheaper to buy, and it's not that they're, and like you can get the top catcher for say JT Realmuto for $16-17 perhaps, and you think that's a good deal, but you have to look at it on a relative perspective. What are your thoughts on that?
All right, so I'm not sure I agree that starting pitchers are more expensive in auctions. I don't think that's true. I think that varies year to year, that varies draft to draft. Even within the NFBC. NFBC is notorious in the main event for pushing up starting pitching. I don't see quite that much of a push in the auction. Like I've done sure. NFBC yeah. auction championship. I've actually seen it less. So that I don't agree with. But it is true the catchers and saves or the closers, you do find that. And that really has to do with the game element of it. And it's really about the runs. Players are not priced in auctions or snakes for some statistics just directly. There's a market premium pricing. Like when I do pricing of a closer, okay, I have whatever in my valuation system spits out. Oh, this guy's worth 17, this guy's worth 14, this guy's worth 13. But people pay more than that in general for faves, right? Some people go 20, 19. It differs by auction. Sometimes they're paying $3 over my values, and sometimes they're paying $5 over my values, and sometimes just one. I don't, for those categories, I don't say, well, it's $5, so the hell with faves, I won't get any closers. Or if just one over, I don't say, well, I'm just going to buy three of them because they're good priced. It's not, the pricing is not absolute in an auction. It's a market premium. There's the inherent price that I think, plus either a market premium or I guess technically a discount if everybody's devaluing them. So I don't see it in terms of that. And that really substitutes the run. When you have a run in the third round versus the fourth round versus the fifth round, and the auction prices are a plus five, plus six, plus three, whatever the market premium is, that's the equivalent of the run. The only difference between the two, of course, is that you can jump in and out of one of those runs in an auction, right? You can draft people in a different order. You can decide whether you be in it or not at any point. If you miss a run, you just miss the player, period. And if you miss, let's say you're in the sixth round and you say, forget it, I'm not taking a closer. There could be five closers taken without any of your control somewhere in the middle, whereas in an auction, you can jump in and get the next one if you don't like the one particular one that's coming up. So the fact that you have that does produce the aberrations where you may get a little bit of a discount where things go a little bit more according to the flow of projections or valuation, whereas in a snake, oh my God, these four closers went, I better get this guy or I won't get a closer. That just pops up the premium of itself. In the catchers, it's the same story. Catchers are really valued based on market premium. I have what my initial prices are for the catcher, but sometimes catchers go hot. Very often, it's a $4 discount on the market. Oh, I take my prices, subtract four, and that's roughly what I get up and down. I take the biggest bargain up and down the curve wherever it is. But again, there's a catcher run. It could be. Maybe it's not the fifth, sixth round as it would be for saves. Maybe it's the ninth, 12th, 15th round. But again, you're playing chicken with the catchers in a snake draft. There's no chicken exactly in an auction because you can be on the very next guy. So I think it's really the game theory element that makes a bigger market premium issue in snakes for a certain category versus auction. You don't have as great because you have the ability to come in and out of every player.
That was an awesome answer. And this is why I love having a podcast, because I get to fortunate to hear perspective like that. That's this is exactly what I think what people want to hear. And that was a great answer. Sure. How do you take advantage of that? How do you take advantage of this?
In an auction, you mean, right?
Yes. In an auction. We're talking auctions.
Yeah. Again, I'm big on separating to the two components. It's not an absolute value. Well, I've got William Contreras, and he's valued at $18. Well, if it's 17, I'll buy him, and if it's 19, I won't. I don't really see that. You have to see what the ecosystem is. Are catchers going for $4 over my values? Are they going for six, right? If a catcher is going for $4 over my value, and everybody else is going $4 over my value, but there's one guy who's only going $1 over my value, that's where you take advantage, is where you play the curve. Ah, it's only one. That's a relative discount to the four over that I would be paying elsewhere. Same thing with saves. If I see that Diaz is going $5 over my value and Duran's going $5 out of the value, but maybe Peter Fairbanks is only going $1 over, that's the spot to get him. It's the best relative market discount, so you don't pay the overage. And by the way, if everybody is going at a discount, if everybody's going $2, $2, $2, well, I want a guy who's going $4 discount, right? The best way to accumulate value in an auction is to accumulate the bargains, and it's not absolute numbers. It's relative to what the market is doing.
Okay, so you said that you disagreed with my sentiment that starting pitching becomes more expensive in auctions, but you did agree that catchers and closers are relatively cheaper. What category of player becomes more expensive, do you feel?
In an auction, what becomes more expensive would be some of the middling players at times. Some of the second tier, or I should say anybody who's coming to the end of a tier. If you're going to have five players in a row who are somewhat priced similarly, just because of the way that supply and demand works in an auction, the last player or two of the tier goes for more expensive. I wouldn't say it's any one specific statistic or position or anything really overdoes it. It's more that you see pockets of being inflated due to artificial auction pressures, right? If you go to a store, if you go to the jewelry store and there's a pot of gold rings and a plate of silver rings and a plate of bronze rings, and you know, if there's only two left in a basket, everyone wants them more. If there's 15 in the basket, they're not going to be willing to go much more over the price than being offered if you have to bargain with the guy who's selling them. So I think that it's not about any specific thing. I think it's more about the general auction pressures in the room and identifying where things run out. Oh, are there any more big stolen base guys? Are there any big outfielders left? Whoever the last tier of outfielders, they're going to go more. The way to take advantage of that, of course, is to get people before they get the last tier. Look at your auction board and nominate some people that are not for the last tier. Get your guys before they come to an economic pressure that's artificial.
In your jewelry store scenario, is Ronald Acuna the one ring to rule them all?
So Ronald Acuna is what I call someone who's in an economic box. There's extreme vertical differentiation and extreme limited quantity. Like if he's the guy who you put in the centerpiece of the entire jewelry store and you shine 75 lights on it, Ronald Acuna, he's not worth $57, folks. He's not. But everybody sees that shiny thing and says, I gotta get that. Wow, that looks really good. Oh, that's the best one. They're all enamored by it. Look, he's the best guy. We know that. If I was in a snake draft, 1-1, there's no question on my mind. But he is the epitome of economic pressure. He is the supply of Ronald Acuna types is one. There's no greater economic pressure than that.
Interesting. So I'll push back on you a little bit because you have cited that the players that become more expensive are tiers that are running up, being positions or categories. And that's sort of the epitome of catcher and closer. So I would say that some would say that your argument is circular in a sense.
No, but you have closers. Let's say there's six closers, right? There's no extra economic pressure right away for any one closer there. If the whole market is valuing a bunch of closers over, they're throwing money out over there. That means that outfielders at the bottom are going to be cheaper. Right. I guess you're right in the sense that if we're saying that closers and catchers are cheaper in an auction than a draft, then the other quantities, sure. Then we're talking about all the outfielders. We're talking about the middling first bit, the corners. Corners would be cheaper if starting pitchers more expensive or whatever is valuing a little bit less by a market, I guess, is valuing elsewhere more expensive. But I don't see things in terms of more expensive or not. If you're looking at things in terms of market premium by position, you really don't care about the differences. I want to get the cheapest outfielder. I want to get the cheapest middle infielder. I want to get the cheapest closer, right? There's less in terms of what's cheaper and what's not cheaper. There's less in terms of what's intrinsically this is more, this is less. It's all relative to the other quantities you can get.
I think I do agree with you that it's the middling players that become more expensive in the auctions. You'll have a player like, say, like Gleyber Torres. A lot of people like him for whatever reason. He's a player that is going more expensive in auctions than he is in snake drafts, perhaps, because of just market, like it's a market demand for him. And I think it's just like, people play ADP chicken in a snake draft, whereas you don't have that luxury, or you do have that luxury in an auction, depending on how you think about it. But I think it's also a big thing based on timing when players are nominated. So I think you'll see, I love to nominate the players near the bottom of the list really early. Like I'll nominate Jung Hoo Lee, really my first nomination, because if he goes late, he'll go for like $3. But if he goes early, there's going to be two people that are going to be bidding back and forth and get him to $8 or $9. So I think that's where I see some of these discrepancies.
Oh, definitely. That's definitely a great auction. I call it the Joey Votto nomination. For the last couple of years, Joey Votto on my value sheets were always like $9. But his ADP, his AAV was like $3. And I don't want to see somebody else get a $6 bargain on Joey Votto. I also didn't want to buy Joey Votto. I didn't want him, but I didn't want somebody else getting that perceived value. So if you do, if you bring them up earlier in an auction, they'll go for more. If you leave them to the end, somebody's going to get them for like a buck. That's one of the reasons why I brought up Jose Abreu in our auction specifically for $1. I figure, okay, I don't really want Jose Abreu. I'm glad to take him at $1, but if people want to bid, maybe he'll get his price up. Well, for that, nobody actually bid. So I ended up getting Jose Abreu for $1, and I was happy. Oh, great. I'll take $1. Well, worst comes to worst, we cut him. He's $1, right? But my value sheet said he's $10. That's great. So that's definitely a great strategy. A lot of people, when they nominate and say, let's get money off the board, they say, just nominate the highest value player. That's really silly because you're actually not creating any extra artificial economic pressure. An expensive guy is going to go expensive. Everyone knows who Tatis is. We don't need to nominate him earlier to get his price up. The guy down low who you don't even want to consider, I want to extract more money from the pool. If I put up Jose Abreu and he would have gone for $4, that's $4 somebody else spent. You know, am I going to get a $4 extra over Tatis because I nominated him early? Probably not, right? You want to nominate somebody who you're going to get more money off the board than you think, not just an expensive guy because he's a high-valued money.
I 100% agree with that. I never nominate those top players early because someone else is going to do that anyways. Why would I do that? Let them do my work for me. I look for players that, A, I'm not going to pay the AAV for. Like I'm probably going to be out. I don't think it's a good price. I don't like the player for whatever reason. And if they can also have the trait of a scarce position. So last year, my guy was Jake McCarthy. He was going his average auction cost. I was out on. I'd rather not have that single point of failure for the stolen bases. And I know that people just like loved him and like he could go for a huge premium. So he was my first nomination. Let people battle for him, get the money off the table. Hopefully he went for $4 or $5 more than what he was. Any guys that you have in mind like that this year?
Mine
would be Rodon this year.
Yeah, like one of those injury guys. Absolutely. Usually for me, it's the young guys. I'm usually out on. I mean, Ellie De La Cruz to me is just absolutely forget it. Like I have no interest in drafting him. So I don't mind if he goes out earlier. Any of the young guys I usually don't find myself buying. So sure, let everybody else roll with them.
Yeah, like Cheerio, not interested.
No, not really. I mean, the hit rate on these prospects really in the first year or in their second year or whenever they're just running with the floor and, oh, my God, he's going to be great, is very low. Yes, we have Corbin Carroll, who was fantastic. Acuna hit the ground right away. Tatis, sure. We have those. But for every two guys that hit the ground, you've got six guys who don't. And I like playing the percentages. I'd rather make a $4 profit on some middling guy than take a huge variance in whether I'm going to be successful or not with a prospect.
Right. In an auction, I looked at your auction. Well, we'll get to it in a second. But do you focus more on ratios and speed with your larger purchases? So I have a question here: is like how many $30 players, $40 players do you want? You can get to that if you can touch on that if you want. But when you're spending when you're allocating a large amount of your resources, are you really want to focus on those scarce categories with them? Like for example, do you want to not spend money on Pete Alonso because he doesn't hit speed, he doesn't hit average. So you're going to be hard pressed to be finding those options later on. And you could be boxed in.
No, I think in a draft, that's the case more because in a snake draft, if you take Pete Alonso, it's harder to find the bits and pieces later on, you typically want to, as best you can, get as more representation of the five categories earlier. It's just easier to build your team in a snake that way. In an auction, any player is available to me at any time, right? If I have to pay a little bit of a premium later for a guy to make up some stats, I can, right? There's nothing you can do in a draft if you miss out on the guys and you're struggling and I have to take this guy here. Well, I guess I have to. You can put it together so many different ways in an auction. You're far more flexible. So I don't worry about that. I don't really say, well, with my big purchase, I need to get this. I don't. I look for what bargains I'm getting. Do I get a bargain from Alonzo? If Alonzo's a bargain, then I'm happy to get him, and I'll get some middling guys with speed later. Happens to be in our particular draft that we did. I walked away with no steals. It was for a couple different reasons I did. One of them was a mistake where I literally was trying to bid on a guy and the computer didn't work. That happens in an online.
I made a mistake.
It happens. Also, we clicked, the plus one, and all of a sudden, oh crap! Somebody just bid three more, and now you're stuck with a guy. Yeah, that happens all the time. So I don't blame the bad strategy. I blame electronics or my using of electronics. but I have no problem with the scarcity of positions. And do I go for ratios or anything? No, I don't really particularly go for or against something. I will say though that I do use the Z-score methodology over the SGP, so there is a little bit more lean towards ratios. ERA, WHIP, batting average do come out a little bit stronger than SGPs, so maybe because of that I would. You did ask about, do I go into an auction and say I want to have a couple of $30 players, $40 players, what number, how many players do I look for? And my answer to that is I do not look for any particular quantity. I'm happy to play zero. I'm happy to have none. In our auction, my highest valued player was Rafael Devers at $29. I didn't have any $30 or $40 players. I just didn't like the prices. But I've been to plenty of auctions where I say, these are pretty good, and I buy three $30 players. It's really auction dependent. I have a plan for each, right? I have a plan that I think is going to happen. I have a contingency plan to know if I get one of these two at a higher spot, I switch around a different slot and take somebody else. So I have contingencies. I have an idea of what's going to happen, but I don't say I got to get something. I'm not looking to fill certain dollar slots. I'm looking to fill bargains.
Right. Okay, and I want to transition over to our actual auction. We did an online championship, $150 buy-in a couple of weeks ago. Bjorn, do you have anything to add before we get into that? Do you have anything you want to say?
Yeah. Before you transition to that, I just wanted to follow up. Last night I sent Ariel just a couple question about like being a good podcaster and the random tips. And number one was to get a good mic. And I wonder if that's why Mike Kurland was removed from this program.
Yeah, Mike was on this program before.
Also, I'm just kidding. I like Mike Kurland, and I understand that you were talking about a microphone, so that is something I'm gonna do. Also, you talked about learning how to segue. Now, would I want to get like a helmet, elbow pads, knee pads? Do I need to take a course to learn how to do that?
Absolutely, you definitely have to get your strap on and be as safe as you can. No, obviously, I'm talking about segueing is just having the flow of conversation, right?
Bjorn has a strap on, I think.
No comment there, Zach.
All right.
So I guess one final thing is like I always hear people talking about, five-star reviews and things like that being really helpful. Do you find that to be the case? Do you think that influences how people can find shows?
It definitely pushes on podcast aggregators. If you have a higher rating, it does push the podcast up. So
one thing I've thought about is, I don't know how ethical it would be, but it, like when people get together for Christmas, I assume they're just grabbing their relatives' phones and rating podcasts and things like that. If your kid says, can I have a friend over? I think the answer should be, do they have a phone and will they let me rate my podcast?
Well, sure. I mean, it is a popularity contest, and there's nothing illegal about doing that. It's ethically gray, I guess. But of course, my kid or my friend's wife is not really interested in listening to any fantasy baseball podcast. What's she doing rating them to begin with? So You guys do what you may at your Christmas parties. I usually don't spend the time to take out people's phones to rate my own podcast. But if you guys want to do that, that's fine by me.
Mine wouldn't even show up for you because I'm in Canada. So you can't, it's a different country. Like I can't see the US ratings. I can't see the US reviews. I can only see the Canadian ones. So my podcast has like two reviews. There's tons of bad ones from the US.
Yeah, I can say that I've never rated this show because I think the ratings reflect that. There are a lot of people that don't like to listen rate this show.
Yeah. The ratings are not, they're not as important because they don't really mean some, but I guess to the aggregators, they mean something. I don't know.
It's how you feel deep down in your heart. If you feel like you're doing a good thing and you're producing a good show and you're getting good information to help you and others from a great guest like yourself, Ariel, that's what's important. It's about making friends and just making everyone, you know, better players and building this community.
Now this last thing before we get into Zach's segment, and it took me back because I was a little like, what the heck are you talking about? Industry analysts invited me to, and you know, close your ears if you're listening in the car with children. He called it a circle jerk, and I'm like, what? That sounds like a sexual thing. It turns out he wanted us to sit in a circle and pass our phones around, and we would jerk up our ratings by rating each other's podcasts. So it was actually totally innocent. So that is what I would recommend to our listeners is participate in a ratings circle jerk. All right. That's our segue. Take it away, Zach.
All right. So I hope you weren't too disappointed, Bjorn, that that's exactly that's what it in fact was. But
Merry Christmas, Bjorn.
It was actually for Valentine's Day.
Oh.
Would we know anyone that was there?
Dale was there. I actually saw Rick Poundstone. But other than that, I don't know if you'd recognize anyone or if they would want to be mentioned. I'd have to clear that with them.
Do they each like buy each other flowers and chocolates for this circle thingy?
Yeah. There was definitely some food exchange, some fluids exchanged. We passed around some beverages, so that was nice. It was really, really a good time.
It's good to see hydrated.
For sure. Electrolytes, prep for fights. That's what they do. Bulk up.
Awesome. Well, thanks for sharing that, Bjorn. So Ariel, in our draft, talk about how one pivot can change the landscape of the entire team. I think you alluded to this just not too long ago.
In terms of in terms of an important player changing the landscape.
Well, yeah, like you said, you sort of missed on speed, right? And then what exactly happened? What player was it?
Yeah, so I think a guy like Nico Horner is a more important guy than I would conceive. That he's not going for a ridiculous premium. You don't have to pay, you know, $30-something for him. He's in low 20s or whatever it is, which is somewhat reasonable for an auction. But because of buying him, he covers average. He covers speed, probably better than people even think. I had Sarah Sanchez on my podcast talking about him, and she said that she thinks he's going to steal 50 bases this year. This is a guy that if you're filling out the rest of your
great, now he's not going to cost more than $20 anymore after she said that.
well, I mean, like look,
25 next.
Well, we're talking about him, but but a guy like that who helps you categorically the rest of the way, because I found that power was probably cheaper than I thought I could get. Not that available on the waiver wire. You need a lot of it, a lot more than you think of it. And so to really build the auction very nicely, Horner would have been a nice get. So that's somebody that I missed on that probably would have helped along the way. Like I think I bought Nick Castellanos, but I probably needed a guy like Horner, even if it was a few bucks more. So I can drop to another $1 player. I could have done that. So that would have been a player I would have gotten. But of course, you know, you pivot, you do what you can elsewhere. You can't cry because you lose a guy in an auction. It's going to happen more than once in a draft.
Right. Now, there's another player that I actually had him on my podcast to talk about this. So he doesn't mind talking about his draft because we discussed it already. Najemi, he had a very heavy hitting approach. He also bought Henry Davis, the outfielder, for $6. I want to get your thoughts on you. Like, there's an intangible cost of buying that Henry Davis player because you have to burn a roster spot essentially, and like the relative cost between him and other catchers is not even that high. So I'll be honest, I don't like that buy. I think it's a poor allocation of funds. What are your thoughts on that hitting a heavy approach? Davis and like a lot of, like, he got a lot of risky pitchers on that team. Manoa, I think Flaherty, if I'm Taj Bradley, like I remember him, he had a $4 max bid remaining with a ton
Severino
of players.
Severino, yeah. Well, I'll talk about his draft in general. And of course, I don't mean to offend him. I'm just giving you my technical approach on him. But in terms of Henry Davis at $6, I mean, I bought Logan Ohapi for $8. I think that just as a pure catcher, period, Ohapi at $8 is quite a bit better than Henry Davis at $6. That's a huge overspend. Like, if you're going to get Davis and you're going to spend $1 or $2 at the end, okay, great. He'll turn to a catcher. Maybe he'll be like a $4 or $5 catcher. Great. You're spending $6. And now you're you're blocking yourself from getting another a $6 outfielder who could help you. I don't like that bit at all. It's an overpriced. It's a bad game theory decision, I think, and it's an overpay for him. I mean, the bump in catcher is $4 or whatever you get. He's not worth paying that much for.
I agree. Anything else about the team in general? I think the one thing that I know is he needed to. He was studs and duds. He allocated a lot of funds to hitting, and then he spent he had $4 max bid left, and he spent all $4 on Taj Bradley, who, in my opinion, might be a $1 or $2. He overspent with limited funds, and we're shitting on specific aspects of this team. I do like a lot of the hitters that he did buy, so I do like those players. Just how he put the puzzle together, I probably wouldn't have done it the way he did it.
Yeah, and no offense to him. A lot of people, I respect people for what they do, and I certainly would have done this. But he had 10 $1 players. That's not even counting Taj Bradley, who you said really is a dollar player. He had the $4 at the end, whatever it is. So it became.
It wasn't at the end. It was in the middle that he got. So he could have, if he spent $2 on him, he could have got two other players for $2.
He's at that level. And Henry Davis, it really is an end gamer too, in my opinion, anyway. So we're talking about like 10 to 12 $1 players. Problem is that, I mean, I'm sure a lot of them will turn out to be worth a lot more than $1 in the end, but a lot of them won't. And now you're going to have to be playing the waiver wire more than you think. And the overall value of the team is just not that great because you're overspending on Mookie Betts. You're overspending on guys, Spencer Torkelson. You're overspending on, he's probably about a $30 Ellie De La Cruz, who is going to solve. Ellie De La Cruz might end up in the minors at some point. The Reds have a ton of infielders. Like, if he doesn't hit right away, they're going to put him to he's going to get the Jordan Walker treatment and go to the minor. He had 215 last year. I mean, he's not a guarantee. I $30 is a huge spend, but I just don't like the build. And, you know, Mookie Betts, he bought Mookie Betts as an outfielder, but look at his other infielders. He's got Semien, he's got De La Cruz, he's got Altuve. Like, you can't even move him to middle infield. Like, I would rather if he bought a $1 middle infielder, and then you can just throw him into a middle infield spot and get another outfielder. Like, the flexibility of his team is worse than it should be. And the pitchers, he's got Castillo, Snell, and then a bunch of nobodies, and he has zero closers. Or he's got Ginkle and Jason Adam for $1. I mean, I don't know. I think that a more rounded approach or a little bit more rounded approach would have been better. I think it was a little bit too extreme. Again, I apologize to you, Najmi. I don't mean any disrespect, but I don't particularly like your team from a bunch of aspects.
Well, the thing with that team also is those relievers, Jason Adam and Ginkle, those were blackjack cards counting off in my head. I'm like, okay, these are reserve round picks that are going in the auction.
Yeah.
I'm gonna get a better team because of this.
I mean, the biggest problem is when you do that ridiculous split of a stars and scrubs, there are players in the middle rounds who are bargains. Like, if you have your max bid is like $8 for the duration of the auction because you spent four $40 players, there's going to be a $10 player who's a good buy, and you're going to miss out on him because you don't have the cash. And there's going to be a $5 player that's a good buy, and you're going to miss out on him. There's going to be a $15 player. When I go to an auction, I want to play in every single price tier. I want to play in the beginning. I want to play in the middle. I want to play in the end and everywhere in between, because there are good bargains at every single price tier. And when you have your value so cornered into that thing, you can't afford to be in it. In general, you want to have the same purchasing power throughout the draft as everybody else. Like, I watched my dollars that I'm somewhere in the pack. Obviously, at times, if I just bought a few players, I'll be on the low side. And if I haven't bought a player in a while, I'll be on the high side. But as to the extent you can get yourself somewhere in the middle, that's really what you want to do, because you want to be able to have the ability to buy anybody at any time. And he did not. So he missed out on a lot of the bargains that I and you and some other people got.
Right. And I think that is a good segue to our, the next question, because I've been in the Yodzies auctions, and I've screwed up auctions where I get shut out of a relief pitcher. And I think, especially in this NFBC format, though, like, you think, oh, I'll get a couple specs for $1 or $2, but it's aggressive. So what is your split on relievers and starters? Do you want a 7 and 2? Do you want a 6 and 3? Because I think in these auctions, because you're sort of confined to buying 9 pitchers, 2 catchers, ADP sort of is different than a snake draft, whereas you have a lot of catchers that are going in the top 345 picks, whereas normally you wouldn't. A lot of relievers are going in the top in the auction rounds that they normally wouldn't. What's your split? Because near the end, like, even the reserve guys, like you saw Ginkle Adams and go, like, all like the backups, like Brash is an automatic buy in these auctions. And you're going to see a change over time. So what's your split? And
I mean, in terms of what I want to play every week, I think it's closer to 6-3, 6 starters, 3 relievers. I don't like playing 7 starters because the 7 starters usually trash or playing a bad opponent that day, right? So it's usually I'm playing 6, sometimes even 5 if the matchups are just awful. But in terms of what you do at the auction, I generally try to say get 6 starters, you know, get 2 relievers, and that last spot, it just depends on what's needed. If I bought 2 lockdown closers, I'll throw that last spot for a starter, right? If I looks like I could probably use a dart, or I like the darts available, sure, I'll take it. I leave that last one flexible, so I don't really go in with a set number. I just know that I have to get at least 6 starters, at least 2 closers, and then, you know, whatever the best thing for my particular auction has to be for the remaining one.
Right on.
I had to head out to a work meeting in just a second here, but I just wanted to take a second to thank Ariel for coming on the show. People should check out Beat the Shift podcast. And also, I just want to speak a little bit about the NFBC in general. Just chatting with Ariel a little bit before the show, just how outgoing he was and willing to take my questions about podcasting and discuss them with me. And I just found everyone in the NFBC to be really likable, you know, Ariel and people like Phil. I don't even talk to Phil about players. What I talk to Phil about is escape rooms. And my goal one day is to be handcuffed with him in Las Vegas in a room for an hour. And maybe we get out, or maybe we just stay in there the whole hour and have a great time. But so many of the NFBC community, they're just it's really welcoming, and just chat with a lot of people, and I appreciate it. And I know sometimes, Zach, you give like lower entry people crap and stuff and whatever, but I think I've mentioned this before, like when I first started, I hadn't even played Roto, and I had never even done a DC draft or understood anything about Roto. Some would say I still don't, and I wouldn't really argue with them. But you helped me out with roster construction and told me what episodes to do and stuff. And I know when you needle people, you're just needling specific people, not a whole community. But anyways,
I play low stakes too.
I know you do. People don't understand that you're making jokes a lot of the time. But Ariel, yeah. I do appreciate you carving out time, and I have to do some work today, but I can't wait to listen to this episode and make sure to check out your podcast too. So thank you for your time, and it was really good listening to what I've heard so far.
Well, thank you so much for the kind words. I really appreciate that. And yeah, I try to be a nice guy. You know, I played in the NFBC before. I was in the fantasy industry. I mean, I do writing and projections and stuff like that. But, you know, before I published anything, I played NFBC first. To me, it's about fantasy baseball, and I just write about what I do. You know, I just, you know, that's how I treat it. I like to get along with everybody, no matter what circle you're in. I'm usually
I've been in a circle or two. Wow, I think that's what we call a segue. I'll leave you guys to it.
Thanks, Bjorn.
Bye.
Yep. Thanks for coming on, Bjorn. I'll talk to you later. So we're almost done here, Ariel. We won't keep you too much longer here. Catchers. We'll just talk about catchers in an auction. Like, again, not to keep bringing Phil up, but he came on the podcast before and he had a strategy that said keep all FAB options open. And I sort of trying to apply that when I'm taking catchers in these FAB leagues. I don't want to have like an opportunity to get, like, say, a catcher that was dropped because of injury or a prospect that gets called up and really have a hard drop. So I tend to allocate my funds to have one good catcher and one sort of one that is an available drop. You took, you have one good catcher, and then you have Diaz from the Rockies. Yep. Who he may be too good to drop anyways, but we're not really sure on how he's doing.
I bought him for $2, so I'm good either way. You know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you're good either way. So if the next best thing comes up, you could drop him. So let's say you were in a big auction in Vegas. I know you're not going this year, but would you steer clear of buying like two catchers for more than $8 each, or would that be something you're okay with?
No, I'm okay with any construct. I generally don't like the construct of buying two $1 catchers, because then you're overtaxing the FAB just for catchers. And now you got to find two diamonds in the rough on the catch. You're going to really find two respectable catchers in the waiver wire pool. It's much harder. I'd rather just limit that to one. So in general, I want to have at least one decent catcher. My original plan usually is, you know, 10-11 bucks for the top catcher, and it could be higher or lower depending upon the bargains out there, and then $2 for the last catcher. And if I find two really good bargains, I have no problem going for the two. If I don't, I have no problem going for the one, right? I do want to make sure I do get one if I can, and I'll get whatever the cheapest market premium is. To me, it was Ohapi at this one, and I took him. And whatever, you know, my last catcher, whatever it is. But I'm comfortable playing any of them. And I think that for auctions, you got to be more flexible and not be hard pressed into any dollar value or any strategy. You got to have a plan for what you think is going to happen, and then contingencies if you find something better.
Right. This last question, we've sort of already touched on it, so I will just close out by asking you, looking at our auction, what stands out at you? Do you have any global thoughts on it that you think would be interesting to share?
Our particular auction that we did was extremely hot. When I compute my values, or anybody takes a projection, especially ATC, because ATC is more middling than anybody else, you don't have many players that are going to be worth $40. You have few players that are going to be worth $30. So when all the people in the beginning are going $50 and $40 and $45, there's nothing for me to do. I just sit back and there's no decision making. I'm not taking any of those there. Not only did they go over my values, but they went over what the AAVs were. Like in the NFBC, if you look at a player card as the auction is going on, it tells you what the AAV is, which is what the player has gone for in previous auctions. People were taking players way over the AAV. It was like one of the top ones. And that just signaled to me, I'm just going to play the middle. Because if people are going way over what I think, way over what the previous market was thinking, there's going to be tons of value in the middle. And I knew that right away. I was trying to get whoever I thought was within striking distance, somewhere in the low 30s, high 20s. And I landed on Rafael Devers at 29. I mean, Devers is arguably a second round pick. Everybody's spending 50, 40 bucks on their top two round picks. And I got Devers at 29. I'm okay with that. That's a good comparative price. And then I got, you know, some more 20s. I got a ton of high teens. And I knew I was just going to soak up the middle. So the instruction is to see what kind of auction it is early on. In a very hot auction, play it safe and wait for the middle. If players are not going much over your values, they're only going $3 over your values, $4 over the values. If you don't get two or three players for $2, $3 over your values, you're going to be stuck in the middle with too much money and you're going to overspend for crappier players. So you got to pounce when the iron is hot. And it's hard for me to tell you if it's going to happen to you or not. It's year to year, draft to draft. But certainly this one and from the AAV so far, it looks like we're back to being hot. I have to say that since COVID, auctions have turned a little bit colder than I'm used to. So I was able to go after higher priced players. Before COVID, it was pretty much hot, and I went middle. We're returning to that a little bit. It's a little bit due to the advent of the fact that steals were pushed up tremendously in the last couple of years. They're not being pushed up as much, and that gives better bargains for higher players. So you're going to see more cold auctions. You should probably, I'm sorry, you're going to see more hot auctions now because players are just going way off the board. And so just be patient. My tip for everyone listening is in auctions this year, until you see otherwise, or until you really see it in your own, be more patient than you think. You don't need to win with a $45 player. You can win with two $25 players.
Awesome. Well said. Ariel, I appreciate the time you spent with me today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me. I knew this would be fun. And so, thank you so much for inviting me. And I hope I was a good guest and, I'm usually very serious on my own podcast. I hope I was a little bit less serious on this one.
Well, I think I had fun. So I had fun. Good. I learned a lot. This is why I do this. So that's all that matters. And I think you did great. And I appreciate your time.
Hi, my pleasure. And enjoy the draft season, everybody.
Yeah, you too. And again, I think you're at ATCNY on Twitter if they want to find you.
ATCNY, only 5 letters.
Yeah, guarantee everyone listening is already following you. But just in case, again, thanks, Ariel. And I'll talk to you later.
All right. Take care.